heart to long for Christ. You're coming so you can start to make room with all the chaos of today in a meditative, intimate way to be able to hear what God is saying to you. And you're coming for community. You're coming for those people that are around you that are also going to be here. So we have said we've wanted this whole Advent season to be a little bit different, where it's not just top-down performance. We want everybody, we're challenging everybody at Mitchell Road to come to all of these nighttime events so that you can start to get your hearts really longing and really ready to celebrate and worship Christ our King. That's tonight. December 3rd is even better. And that being said, Sharon and Dan are going to be great. I mean, that being said, they're going to be phenomenal too. But the next week is a big choir thing. That's not just choir. You're going to be an active participant in that as well. There's an orchestra. There's Kingdom Kids. It's going to be a great celebration where we gather our hearts and our voices to celebrate who God is. And then I want you to see, this is different. On December 10th at 6 o'clock, we're going to have the children's choir. Again, you're not just a participant, observer, you're a participant in all of these services. There's going to be times for you to sing and you to worship as well. December 10th, with these kids singing the choirs, I said in the first service, if you don't like kids singing Christmas carols, then something's deeply wrong with you. You know, you're probably a communist or something else, because kids singing Christmas carols is as pure worship as it gets. But after this night where we celebrate and we watch the kids sing, and maybe you don't have a kid singing. You're not coming for the kids performing. You're coming for community. You're coming to get your heart ready for worship. You're coming for the whole season to see what God might do. After December 10th, we're going to come into here, and we're going to make little gift bags with everybody. We're going to have music on and hot chocolate, and we're going to come in here and make these gift bags on the night of December 10th, that on December 17th, after we come in on that Sunday night and we worship again, upbeat worship and carol sing and hymn sing, we're then going to take these gift bags that we put together the week before, and we're going to go caroling out to these apartment complexes that are all around, and we're going to give love and kindness and light in the middle of darkness. So that's different. I mean, most of the things that we've done in Advent is come watch this performance, come watch this happen. No, we're asking for a higher participation because we want our hearts to be churned. And we also want to find a way this year to reach out into the community. These apartments, they watch us come in and out and in and out and in and out of this facility, but we've had very little outreach to them, especially for you millennials that love justice. And you love all those. This is where you do it. This is how you do it. You form a relationship. You bring something to bear. You bring a gift to somebody who could benefit from it. And we're super excited about that. And then, of course, the 24th. Now, I don't want to take up any more time of Russ's time. Let me introduce him, and then I will read the scripture and have him come preach to us. Russ Hightower, PCA pastor. Every Thanksgiving. Not every, but many Thanksgivings, he's here visiting his family. And I always say to him after, why didn't I have you preach? I could have had the week off, and they could have heard a better preacher. And this is the first time I've actually thought about calling him ahead of time. I'm so glad he was willing to say yes on this week. He's a son of this church. He's part of the fruit of this ministry. Went to Princeton Seminary, ministered in New Jersey, in Chattanooga, and Mississippi. And now is being called by God to plant a church outside L.A. in Santa Monica area, in the Bay Area, underneath the offices of Pacific Crossroads, Rankin Wilburn, who I've referenced before, a friend of mine as well. And I want you to see that a product of this church is taking the gospel to areas in this country, just like Brian Loney did. We had him in a couple weeks ago, just like he took the gospel to Boston. Russ is being called with his wife and two kids to take the gospel to L.A., and so may this tribe increase. May our influence in this nation increase. May we get a vision as a church for the influence we could have around this country. But he's not there to promote that. I'm promoting that for him. He would love support and prayers. He's here to remind us of who Jesus our King is. And so let me read to you from Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. And then the text for today, Psalm 2, as we start this new series, Christ in the Songbook of the Church. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and we've come to worship him." And when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it's written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him.' And after listening to the king, they went on their way. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way." And then from Psalm 2, "Why did the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, 'Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us.' He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, 'As for me, I've set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, "You are my son. Today I've begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a porter's vessel. Now, therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear. Rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all that take refuge in him." This is the word of the Lord.
Mitchell Road, it is good to be home, back at the church where I grew up. He comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found. We sang that, one of my favorite Christmas hymns this morning. Let me talk to you about that for a second. I want you to imagine that this summer of 2018, that sounds a long way off, it's this summer, right here across the street, a single mom and a three-year-old boy move in. How is Mitchell Road going to love that family? How are you going to see his blessings flow out to that family as you care for them, as you think about them, what it means for this church to love this community? Well, if you pull out today and you see the apartments right there, look next to them. There's these little duplexes to the right if you turn right. And I want you to know that 40 years ago this summer, that story is about my mom and me moving in across the street from Mitchell Road. And 1978 in the South, you go to church on Sunday. So we came to visit Mitchell Road. But that's not why we kept coming back. We kept coming back because we were loved well here. You loved us. You came after us. I remember as a little kid, some of you, you're new because the church has grown, and that's wonderful. But some of you know what a train wreck I was, and in many ways still am, and pursued me nonetheless. Just last week, the Lord called home Barbara Thompson. And when we moved further away from the church, she would drive over and pick me up and bring me to Vacation Bible School. There's so many stories like that. I mean, some of you were my Sunday school teachers, and you know I was the kid who loved to raise my hand and say, "What about the dinosaurs?" And I wasn't interested at all in the answer to the question. I just wanted to derail your lesson and get us off topic. And all the way through, people kept coming after me and loving me and pursuing me, not just teaching the love of Christ in content, but embodying who Christ is and how he loves. And all the way up through, and I got into middle school and high school, names like Butch Garman and Jimmy Dodd and Dan Dather investing in me. There was a guy named George Champlin who spent crazy hours. He didn't even work on staff, and he gave hours and hours to a bunch of self-centered teenage boys. And of course, you're in high school, and you think, well, of course the world, I'm worth his time. And I get older, and I think, this is a huge sacrifice that he would come and love us in that way and point us to Jesus. So then I go off to college, my gifts begin to pop, and I wind up going to seminary, and I'm wrestling with different things, and I come back. Some of you know Charlie Bale. He was the missions pastor here. He took me under his wing, challenged me, kicked my tail in some places when I needed it, loved me, and equipped me and sent me out. And now I've served in ministry. I did youth ministry on my own. I did senior pastor, and we're going to Los Angeles. This is the thing I'd want you to hear from me, the mother church. Most of what I have learned about how to do ministry was formed right here. It's not just that missions happens when you send somebody like me to Los Angeles. I want you to know that missions happen because you loved the people right next door. And I'm a product of that. And I want you to hear me clearly on Thanksgiving say to my mother church, thank you. Thank you. Continue. Praise God for that. You are instruments of making His blessings flow throughout this world. Now, with that in mind, turn to Psalm 2. We're going to look at this coronation psalm. It's a psalm about crowning the king. And many Old Testament scholars would say it was likely used in the Davidic dynasty for many of the kings that followed. They would read this maybe at their coronation, whether it was Solomon or many others that followed as the kingdom divided. But even the most critical scholars who would like to say this is just a text about the immediate context recognize these promises, these threats, they're too grandiose. They can't just be about back then. It's too huge. And even the term here, when it says they stand against, in verse 3, they stand against the Lord and His anointed one. Anointed one and His chosen one. It's literally in the Hebrew, Messiah. So it shouldn't be surprising. This text was connected with the idea that there was a king coming and they were looking forward to Him. And then when Christ comes, well, over and over again, the New Testament talks about this. The Father speaks it at Jesus' baptism. This is my Son, whom I love. I'm proud of Him. This is my boy. Listen to Him. The Transfiguration, it's said again. It's quoted again about His resurrection in Acts 4 and Acts 13. Again, in Romans 1, Paul cites it as a sign of the resurrection. Over and over again, this psalm is pointing back to Christ. Sinclair Ferguson says, you know, if you read carefully, in the road to Emmaus in Luke 24, Jesus says, He sits down with the disciples. He opens the word to them. Their hearts burn within them as He says, do you see, the Bible's, it's about me. Look at all these places they're talking about me. It says in the law, the Pentateuch, the first five books. It says, then the prophets. And then in the Psalms, which are studying about Christmas and the coming of the king. And where did they get this idea? After Christ was raised and the 40 days He spent before He ascended, He said, these texts are about me. And that's why over and over again they cited them. Now, I know I've jumped in with big theological categories, you know, redemptive historical, the big narrative arc of Scripture. And some of you may be here, it's Thanksgiving, you came to see Grandma, and you had to come to church because Grandma said so. We're glad you're here. So let me back up for a minute. Because I remember very well my freshman year in college and being in religion classes. And you hear a text like this, and this is now Christmas, and it's good news, and we're here to celebrate looking toward Christmas coming out of Thanksgiving. And you read this text, are people paying attention? It talks about a God who's angry and wrathful and His fury can break out. It can flare up in a moment. You better kiss the Son or you might get smacked. And this sounds like my freshman religion class where the professor says, you know, you almost get the sense that this is a Bronze Age deity, not fully developed, maybe childish, and he's like Kim Jong-un. He's kind of a tyrant, and if you get the wrong way with him, he's like, well, I'm going to take my ball and go home to the good place, and that leaves you to go to the other place. And you read Psalm 2, and that's not good news, unless you're rallying around the fire to make fun of those people. And he laughs derisively at all those over there. What are we dealing with? And if intellectually you immediately say, scoff, we can't take any of this. Here's what I want you to hear this morning. Put that aside for a minute. I want you to hear me say two things. Two things we're going to look at from this psalm. First, it's actually worse than you think. And then it's actually better than you could imagine. All right? So, two things. Christmas is about the coming of the king. Christmas is a threat, and Christmas is a refuge. All right? Verses 1 through 3, you see this over and over again. They talk about plotting in vain, breaking the bonds. They want to throw off this authority. Bill Allen was a deacon in my church in Chattanooga. He was a World War II veteran. And he loved to tell stories. You know, this old guy loved to laugh, and he tells stories. This is one of my favorite stories of his. He says, you know, Farmer Smith is working on the farm, and he's in the garden. He's got his hoe, and he's going at it, and he hears noise. He looks down the road, and here down the gravel path comes one of those standard-issue government vehicles. You know, it looks like an unmarked cop car. He knows what's coming. This guy comes over the hill and gets out, and with all the pomp and circumstance of a self-important individual, you know, you can almost see the agent getting out with the aviator sunglasses. And this guy gets out and says, excuse me, Farmer Smith. I'm an agent from the Drug Enforcement Administration. We have reason to believe there's some nefarious activity on the premises, and we're going to search the grounds. Yes, sir, officer. All right, I understand. Said the Farmer Smith says, one thing I tell you, you can go anywhere you want, just don't go in that field over there. Well, immediately, you know, the agent's taken aback. He says, I don't think you heard what I said. I'm a DEA agent. He reaches in his back pocket and pulls out the badge. He says, do you see this badge right here? Yes, sir. Yes, sir, officer. Do you know what this badge means? I don't know. This badge means I can go anywhere I want. I can do anything I want. No questions asked. Do you understand? Yes, sir, officer. All right, then. And he puts the badge back in his pocket, immediately turns around, and smugly walks straight toward the field he was told not to go into. And Farmer Smith kind of shrugs and gets his hoe and gets going again and watches this agent disappears over the hill. A few minutes go by, and a scream of terror goes up. And Farmer Smith stops what he's doing, looks up, and over the hill comes this DEA agent running at top speed with his prize bull, Farmer Smith's prize bull, chasing him over the hill. And he runs over to the fence, stands on the middle railing, leans out with all of his might, he cups his hands and says, show him your badge. And Bill Allen story. Now, it's funny because in the story, who are you? With whom do you identify? I mean, immediately we tend to think of ourselves as the farmer. And we know what people are like who are self-important and grab authority in false ways and how they manipulate. It's the reason we're cynical and jaded about government, about politicians, all these kinds of things. I mean, I think of my roommate in Big River with played Pap Finn, who, you know, Huck Finn's daddy, and sang the song, Dadgum Government. You know, that's the way we think about authority. These false people with their sense of self-importance. When you come to Psalm 2, the Bible surprises by saying the default setting of the human heart is the DEA agent. We assume authority. And we start to put God in that role. And that's what happens here is now you look at those verses 1 through 3 and they speak out and they speak and who stands against the Lord and His anointed? They say, we would throw off the bonds. We're going to break these shackles. We want to be free from all the constraining of religion. And I know many people, you hear religion, it's all these rules. It's really designed just to keep you from having fun and keep you in order and control you. You know, Marx, all the opiate of the people type stuff. And the Bible says exactly the opposite. The reality is you were designed in a particular fashion. And you can live at odds with that design, but you bring wrath on you. And it's not even that God has to say, I'm the bull and I'm charging after you. No, you go against your design and the fury comes down. You bring it on ourselves and who we are and how we operate. So let me ask you it this way. What is the rule that runs your life? What is the thing that you live by? You know, what is it that you do and how you operate? What is the authority of your life by which you do your day-to-day living? I'm going to give it to you from a secular guy. His name's David Foster Wallace in an essay he wrote called This Is Water. Listen to what he says here. Because here's something else that's weird but true. In the trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. Now, let me pause right there. If you're here and you're an atheist, welcome. I'm not taking pot shots at atheists. David Foster Wallace is actually a prominent atheist author. And so hear what he says in that context. He's talking about functionally how we live. Listen to what he says here. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they're where you tap real meaning in life, then you'll never have enough. You'll never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, and you'll always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. Now hear what he's saying. You give control of your life over to something, and it will begin to own you. I know for some of you, you hear the word worship. We can't help. We're in a worship service. There are certain things that connotes. Let's back up. I want you to hear the word etymologically. The Old English root word for worship is worte. And you can almost hear the connection. Worth. What's worth it? What's worth your time? When you step outside this facility today and you go and decide what you're going to do, what is the centerpiece of your schedule? What decides everything else? If this was a solar orbit, what has the gravitas at the center that decides what you're going to do? Why? Is it NFL games? Is it lunch with the family? I got to think about what's happening in my job tomorrow. What drives what you do from here? The gravity in the middle, the rule. And what David Foster Wallace is saying is you will give control of your life functionally to something, whether it's money or beauty or job or reputation, significance, my family. Whatever the thing is that you give that control over to, that thing will begin to eat you alive. It will demand that you die. Let me give it to you the way Jesus says it. In John 8:34, Jesus says, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Hear that language, slave. It was in our Romans confession earlier where Paul, this great author of a third of the New Testament, says, I know what I should do and I still don't do it. There's mastery. Even an advanced Christian, he recognized, I've got a false king in my life. I've got something else I've given control of my life to and it's owning me. And it begins to destroy me. And now, in order that I be successful in my job, I have to do this. Or in order that my family be okay, if something's wrong with the grandkids, the bottom drops out. If somebody gossips about me, my reputation is gone and I melt. And the Bible's saying, do you see evidence of it? Look, did you notice the question at the beginning? Why do the nations, it doesn't say nations fight each other. Why do they rage against God? Why? If God's inviting, it's kind of like saying to Adam, why are you naked in the garden? I didn't know you. Where are you? God knows he's inviting thought. What is owning me? What drives my identity? And if you give control over to this thing, Christ is saying, it kills you. It is killing you. This is the reason C.S. Lewis said, the gates of hell are locked from the inside. Because what happens is we begin to say, I want this king. I want this thing. If I could just be that. In my line of work, especially in the PCA, it's Tim Keller. Did you hear what Tim Keller said? You know about Tim Keller? Tim Keller did this, Tim Keller. Young 40-something pastor is one day, maybe. And if Tim Keller walks in the room, I'm nobody. And that's kind of, now I have no identity. And for some of you, you're like, I don't even know who that is, but you know who Ted Turner is. You know who, Brad Pitt is. You know whoever it is that you would look to and say, I wish I looked like that. I wish I had that reputation. There's the woman in town who does that really well. I wish I was like her. I wish we had a family like theirs that wasn't always in disarray. Our Thanksgiving is everybody hating each other, And you look and say, if only, we're giving mastery away. That's my king. That's my king. Now, here's where I've come around. Here's the big punch from this psalm. When the real king comes, who's most threatened? The old king, right? Remember the Christmas story? We just read it, Matthew 2, Herod. We talk about, we three kings, the little wise men, they come along, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and they get to Herod, here's a palace, where's the new king? We used to have a pageant over in Chattanooga. All my high schoolers, they wanted to be Herod. I want to worship him too. It's immediately, you understand, he's got to die. And we think Christmas is this beautiful story. I don't like the Easter God. The Easter God's all bloody. But pretty baby and life and peace on earth and everything's hunky-dory. And you read the Christmas story carefully and it's a bloody mess. Matthew 2, the massacre of the innocents. Herod slaughters all these babies because he knows. If a new supposed king shows up, you got two options. You crown him or you kill him. And throughout Jesus' life, from the time he was born until he was killed on the cross. Dick Lucas puts it this way. I think it's very sharp. He says, Jesus' life demonstrates to us that given the chance, we want to kill God. Let that wash over you. The beginning of the Christian faith is an admission that the primary problem in my life is, like Adam and Eve, I want to do kingship my own way. I don't trust that God's going to do it the way it should go. And I'm going to do it myself. And God says, that denial of reality is killing you. That's what hell really is. And extended to an eternity, that's what that is. And we give control of our life that way. And the good news, you're going to hear the good news on it. It's this, is the world this messed up? It's that messed up. And here comes the good news of God. You will give mastery of your life over to something. Every other master in this world will demand that you die for it. For your job, your reputation, your family, money, significant. You pick the poison. That master will demand that you die for it. There's only one master who's willing to die for you. Let me show it to you from the text here. If you are critical and you look at this text and you said, I don't know about this. This God's so full of fury. What's he doing? I hate a God like this. I just want a God of love. Well, hold on a minute. What kind of world do you think we have? You know, Miroslav Volf has had maybe the best response to this. He grew up in Bosnia and Serbia and saw genocide. He said, people who say, I just believe in a God of love, not all this bloody stuff, all this mess. He said, wait a minute. You believe in a God who just accepts everybody? Yeah, just as they are. You don't want things to change. I mean, I want a king who's going to say, this is not flourishing. Genocide's not okay. Human trafficking has to go. Race, if you're, you know, Andy joked earlier about millennials and social justice warrior. If you care about justice, you want a God who is going to, as Miroslav Volf put it, I will not worship a God who will not bring a final end to injustice. That God's not worthy of my worship. And read now. Go back to Psalm 2 and you read this. The fury of God. Would you want anything less than that response to genocide? It must stop. You're like, well, who's going to get crushed? I'm going to get crushed. Now we go to the life of Christ. Look at what he says here. I set my king on this holy hill. And God says, I do kingship unlike anyone else. I send, I'm invincible, I'm omniscient, I'm omnipotent. And now I send a little baby, fragile, breakable, to people who, given the chance, will kill him. This is how I do kingship. The holy hill that he's crowned upon is Calvary. That he looks out, and instead of saying, look at Psalm 2, look at the fury of God, it's coming down on you, he says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. His murderers. Now God says, this is how I do kingship. I turn my enemies into family. There's no other love like this. There's no other king like this. Now I know for some of you, I can say this is inspiring. You're like, oh, I like Christmas. It's an inspiring time. If this is just inspirational fairy tales, it's a waste of our time. It's actually, I think it's worse than that. Let me tell you why. I know some of you just came from a Thanksgiving table where there was a new empty spot, and it hurts. You know, or you've got a dad who's in a nursing home and he calls 6 times a day and he doesn't understand why he's in this facility and his mind's going. And you see signs of death easing in. What good does this coming king do for this? He comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found. I'm not seeing it. A picture, and I'll be personal when we go home, all right? Here's the picture. When I was in New Jersey, South Carolina boy in New Jersey, most densely populated state in the country, right? That goes well. And so one of the things I begin to learn, drive up Route 1, and you know, here you go, I'm in town, I'm in the country, I'm back in town. And there you go, town, 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 town. And there's a little sign that says, entering township, and they're all on top of each other, just stacked up. It took me a long time to begin to adjust to, there's not much open space here, you know? But come spring every year, you know, we're in this cold Jersey climate, and spring would pop, and the flowers are out, and we would get out, and we'd walk a mile down the road, and there was this big, huge, open field. The road went through it, and cars would all stop, and on a Saturday, the place was packed with people, because it's open field. People come, they're having picnics, their kids are playing, they're throwing the frisbee, they're having a blast. And it took 3 years for me to dawn on me, like, this is not normal here. There's not many, why is there this field here? And I looked up, there's huge columns on one end. It's a national park. Why you got a national park in the middle of a packed place like this? Oh, this is a battlefield. It's a battlefield park. We talk about an oxymoron. And what had happened is, if you're a historical buff, you know, you remember the crossing of Delaware, where George Washington crossed the Delaware. It was a surprise maneuver. He had this terrible winter, and it looked like the Revolutionary Army was losing, and George Washington sneaks across, and they have a couple skirmishes with the British, and they beat him in Trenton and in Princeton. Now, the British thought, no big deal. For the Americans, it was the first sign of any possible victory. New recruits started coming in. The tide of the Revolutionary War shifted. It was where the victory began to happen. And suddenly it dawns on me in this field, like, children are playing and laughing. Men died here. Blood was spilt here. How in the world can we dance and play now where blood was covering the field? And the light goes on, because that's how the victory was won. Do you understand why we have a cross, you know, in our windows, over the steeple, jewelry that you wear? It is ridiculous that an instrument of death, I mean, some people who are outside Christianity say, are you a cult of death? Our God says, this is how my kingship works. It's so opposite from everyone else. I take the worst thing that could ever happen to you, and I turn it inside out. The worst thing that could ever happen, I take on me. When it says, take refuge in me, I'm the only king that you can take refuge in. Every other king will demand that you pay, and I pay, I cover you. And even death will be conquered, because I was crowned in your place. Let me tell you why this is very personal for me. Maybe for some of you. Let me tell you about the Hightower family Christmas. In 2009... I was finishing up in Chattanooga. I'd been in youth ministry for a decade, and God was calling me on to a senior pastorate in Mississippi. And we kind of had two churches loving on us at once. And my wife and I are very excited. It's an exciting time. Amanda was pregnant, and we were ready to have our second child, a little girl. And all of a sudden, she calls me a few days before Christmas, and she says, I think I'm in labor. Uh-oh. You know, it's only a couple weeks early. It's not crazy early. So we rush over to the hospital. Family drives over. You know, we're excited. Everything's going well, and they're coming in and checking on us, and the doctor comes in and he says, something's a little off here. We're going to need to watch this. Something's happening with your contractions. And then later he comes back in and he says, blood pressure's really dropping for your daughter. When the contraction hits, we think we need to do an emergency cesarean. We're like, okay, whatever you think. And so they go in, and they begin to do the operation for us, and we're there, and we're excited, but we're praying and thinking, and then my daughter comes. And it was a painful time for us. Immediately, I can see she's swollen, and she codes immediately. And they have to start trying to revive her. Well, my wife can't see. I just collapse over her, and I'm weeping with her, and we're praying. And they get her back breathing, her heart going, and they take her away. We don't even get to hold her. They take her away with the machines, and they come, and they say, we need a name. We need a name. And Amanda and I had been arguing about the name, you know, as we tend to. We thought we had weeks left, you know. And Amanda's name she was excited about was Viviana. And I was like, that's it. Live and grace. Daughter, let my daughter live. God, let my daughter live. That was our prayer. And so we go back to the room and we're really in shock and just kind of recovering and with family. And the doctors come and they tell us, look, it wasn't in the ultrasound 6 weeks ago. She had a clean bill of health, but she has a very rare cancer, neuroblastoma in her liver. It almost never manifests before birth. It's rarely ever in the womb. If it had been after birth, there would be something we could do, but I'm sorry, there's nothing we could do. And we had our daughter for 3 days, and she died on Christmas Day in 2009. Now, why do I tell you that story? How in the world does the Hightower family celebrate Christmas? If this is a fairy tale, it's the worst lie I have ever heard, and get it out of my face. But if this is news, that we have a king who really came and conquered death and gave his life, you know what God's saying? Russ, I know what it's like to lose a child, early, to lose a child wrongfully. And this is how I do kingship. I will take the worst of this on me. And even death can't stop this. Not only will you get your daughter back, not only will you get the time back, you will get her back as she was meant to be, and more than that, I want you to see the kind of king that I am. There's no other love like this, that I will transform all of this reality, all the injustices, the things that are crushing you, I have done something about, and I love like this. My kingship, unlike yours, will bring flourishing. And my family, under my leadership, gets crushed by daddy's idols. But there is a king. The whispers of Camelot, the whispers of Lord of the Rings, all the things. You're looking for that king, the one who would come and heal everything. And we would spend eternity watching him. I know, I had a youth group. I know my students thought, eternal worship? That sounds like hell to me, you know? Do you understand what it means to be close to the King who loves like this? Who would spend eternity redeeming things like that and transforming us and spinning out new realities? Christmas is news, not a fairy tale, news that the King has already come and he's coming back. And that's what makes us worship. And that's what makes us able to sit with an empty chair at the table. And that's what makes us able to say, Christmas is a threat to me and how I operate is I want to put this off. But there's a refuge. So brothers and sisters, who is your King? Let's pray. Jesus, we need this. I need this. I pray for my family as they rejoice and grieve at different times. I pray for those who are hurting in this room, who are suffering. You would meet them in that. I pray for the cynics in the room who have said, I've given this to God and he didn't do it the way I wanted. And we hate you for not being king the way we want you to be king. Break through, Jesus. For those of us who are running so severely to make our jobs our identity, to make our significance in something else, and it's killing us. Lord, help us to see there is one master who gave himself for us, that you do kingship unlike anyone else. Come and transform us, Lord. Let us rejoice that we have a king like you, that we can live in that grace with that joy. We ask it in your name. Amen.
As a battle cry.